Estoril 15. Are you telling me about an incident at Patras when you found this hut?
We went into this hut when they opened the door, and they didn't. It was very gloomy, that hurricane lamps. And the first impression was a long chestnut bench with wooden forms and all these characters seated on either side of the bare bench with great big bottles of this red seamer and bowls of raw cauliflower and bowls of salt. And all around the walls were fishing nets and fishing tackle and oars in the loft and things like that. And there's obviously a fisherman's inn. And the maid is welcome and invited us to have a drink. And I thought, oh, I hadn't liked that scene, but whatever. Dip this raw cauliflower in the salt. And then take a swig of that scene, and it revolutionised it. It made it took the resin, which is from whence it derives its name, it sort of nullified it and it made it very good. And had we been able to do so, we would have doubtless remained there forever. But we had time for a couple of drinks, and the guard commander decided that it was time that everything was all right, and it was time we departed, so we had to go back. This was a mobile guard, not a fixed guard. And so from then on, actually, I got quite a liking for that scene. I never really liked ouzo, although I drank a fair amount of it. And there was another wine called, a very sweet one, called Mabry Daphne. A very dark, sweet wine. And there were several other wines.
Where would you drink them, normally?
Well, in Athens, you used to go to these clubs and bars, quite a lot of bars.
And
so-called restaurants, although they didn't have much stuff here.
What were these bars like?
Well, it depends on the... Some of them were very nice. Some of them were purely honky-tonk type, full of prostitutes and pimps and God knows what. Dens of thieves, but some of them were very well appointed and very nice. And of course, the clubs, nightclubs, there was one under a cinema, quite a large one, and got very good entertainment there. There were some first class acts. There was an extremely good acrobatic group, and a dog that sang to a violin, quite remarkable, and some performing dogs. It was quite a good place. But they put out the bombs to other ranks that was made up of the owner.
Did you have any problems with, I mean, they're strong drinks, Retsina and Ouzo, compared to, beer, perhaps what you're more used to drinking. Was there any trouble, or did you have any trouble with it?
Some people did, but Ouzo was like any other drink. If you drink it the way it's supposed to be drunk, you've got to add water to it. And not drink it as if you were drinking a pint of beer. And then it was all right. But if wondered if he can go blind. They were very fortunate not to have seen him. But you say we were used to beer. I was used to beer, but I was also always used to spirits and whiskey in particular, so it wasn't such a problem to me.
Now, anything else about your time or any of the entertainments in Athens? They had some dances there, I believe.
Had some dances, yes.
What were they like?
Well, quite good. There weren't many females at first, but as a group of Velas gradually disintegrated, people came out of the shells, they were more welcome. And I met one of these clubs, quite a good one. I met the, I thought he was the manager, but he and his brother were owners of it, and I had an office in which they invited me for a drink occasionally, in the hope that they might be able to bribe me to get them something. Again, chocolate, soap, blankets, anything like that. And they always used to pull in English whiskey out. And they didn't have a tremendous stock of this stuff. And the elder brother had been educated at Oxford University in his youth. He's quite an old man. If I'm not mistaken, his name was Papadopoulos, George Papadopoulos. And one of his brothers was chief of detectives in Athens, and he was associated with one of the principal opera singers, female, but, and through them I got a free invitation to the opera house, and we were putting the Merry Wheel on in Greek. I knew the music of the Merry Wheel, so I could say a few Greek words, but I mean, just the same as anybody else, like good morning, good night, Calamera, Calistera, and all this business. But it was quite a good show, and it was certainly a brilliant singer. She had a beautiful voice. And I was introduced to her, and that you were made to feel most welcome.
It sounds like you got on well with the Greeks.
I did, yeah.
That you liked them as well as they were reasonably.
Yeah, I liked them, and they got on well with me by and large. This was, of course, after the pressure was up. And then there was the cinema we used to go to. I can't remember the name of the street, it was up towards the Royal Palace. And there was very few incidents that happened. There was a big near the day that we visited. There was quite a lot of entertainment, really.
Now, you weren't in Greece long. I mean, you got there in December, and I think you left round about March.
Yes.
Might have been into April. April, yes. How did you feel when you knew you were going back to Italy?
I don't think anybody was keen on going back to Italy at all. And even more so in my case, because I applied, along with a number of others, to remain in Greece with the British military mission.
Now, what made you want to do that?
Well, because I was getting along so well with the Greek people, and I thought it would be a good thing to do. But one thing stopped me. I never had a bad record as a soldier, but I was at this particular nightclub on one occasion, and believe it or not, they used to send a car up to pick me up, a civilian car, and take me down to this nightclub, much to the amazement of quite a lot of people. And I'd gone to it on this particular night, and there was a curfew on, and I'd overstayed the curfew. And I came out with a friend of mine, and the military police were patrolling, and we saw them coming up the street from the square. It used to be called Red Square, that's a name of it. But we decided to stay where we were, because it was in the was set back to sort of fire, and it was dark. And just at that moment, we heard this bloke moaning in the gutter, and he was a petty officer in the Royal Navy. He was lying there as drunk as he could possibly be. And we nipped out, picked him up, and the only way, and he was cursing and swearing, and we stood him up and told him to shut up. And I was holding him on one side, and this other bloke was holding him on the other. And this jeep with the military police in went past them, stopped and reversed. And a corporal jumped out and raised his hand, his finger, and said, "You." And that was the petty officer in the middle. And waved, motioned him to come here with his fingers. And we had no choice but to let go of him. And as soon as we let go of him, he fell flat on his face. And so we were all shoved into the police station. The military police had the civilian police station down towards the harbour. And we took all our, I don't know what happened to the petty officer, they took all our numbers, ranks and names, etc. The point in our affair was we weren't drunk, you know, we'd had a lot to drink, but we weren't incapable. And so they took us back to our own unit, and our own unit to follow them. They had a tented area with barbed wire around, sort of a guard room. And everybody was defenders with it. So I slung into this thing, and that party has to lie on. And the next morning, which was a Sunday morning, I was rudely awakened with a boot in my ribs saying, "Get up, you bloody horrible man." The RSM, and I was due to play rugby for the battalion against a South African doctor's team of South African medics anyhow. And at 10:30 a.m. because of the heat, you know, early kickoff. And I got a right rollicking and all of it and down a little bit tiring down this area and get out there and get TK and do something with it. I went to play it in the first 20 minutes of the game. I must have died a thousand times because it was quite warm then and my head was pounding. So I didn't really get on all. My head was pounding. Because you see how they were faster than it was. And they shortened the first half because it was getting so hot. Shortened it by 10 minutes and decided to do the same with the second. And by then I was beginning to get myself put together and I was. Perspiration was absolutely pouring out of me. It was out of some of the others who hadn't even had a drink the night before. And the game continued and it got hotter and hotter. And I can't remember the score, but I know they were beaten by at least 40 points to 3. And I was returned to them. The MPs had asked me if I wanted to be tried by my own CEO, and I said yes. So on the Monday morning, I appeared before the CEO, and he gave me a good talk to it, etc., etc. And gave me 14 days confined to barracks and extra guard duties, which was very lenient, I thought, really. And I accepted that gladly. But about 4 days later, I had to go for an interview for this British military mission, along with about 12 others, 11 others, and I said half a dozen words and I was rejected immediately, and I'm sure that's the reason. And then luckily caught the book in a terrible way. They asked me why I wanted to be with them, and that's how I got on around the Greeks, and I think they obviously thought they'd get on too well with them. Not reliable, and that was it.
Was part of the reason that you just didn't want to go back to Italy as well, or did you not know at that time?
We knew we'd have to go somewhere, but we didn't know at that time that we were going back to Italy. But then again, a couple of days later, my father had to go back to Italy. So that was it.
Now, the book makes quite a play about that they got on well with the Greek women. Was there much trouble? I mean, that can cause trouble between local population and occupying army. Was there much trouble about the women?
Well, there was a certain amount, but there was tremendously far greater number of women than there were Greek women than there were Greek men at that time, because apart from all the Greek men that had been killed or whatever, a lot of them were imprisoned somewhere, or they were hiding from the authorities, you know. So there's a lot of spare women floating about of all ages, young and old. So I don't think it really caused a lot of bother. I can't recall any incidents from it.
Were you aware, I mean, when you went back to Italy, that the war was actually nearly over? I mean, but did you know that it was coming to an end when you left Greece?
Not really, no.
So
I thought, well, here we go back again, like. And with quite a degree of a surprise.
What do you remember about, anything special about the crossing? Because she landed.
No, it was a fairly small crossing. It was a bad ship.
Really, And you landed at Taranto.
Yes.
Now the next period, I mean, you weren't in action, I don't think, or they were following up. What do you remember about the month or so before the end of the war in Europe?
Oh, once we realised that it was virtually the end, we were naturally wondering where we were going to finish it and what was happening. But we were much more relaxed in the days than we'd been for a long time. And when we left Udine to go to Austria,
Hang on, before we get... What about... So, you don't really remember the move up through Italy. What about the actual...
I remember the move up through Italy, only in as much as it was... a matter of interest, really, to see all the places that we hadn't been to, what had happened.
What about... There was a sort... On May the 8th, there was a sort of grand fete, and... competitions and a decorated Jeep contest. Do you remember any of that?
Yeah, that was great.
Did you decorate yours?
I didn't have one at the time, but I was concerned in it in general.
What did they do to the Jeeps?
Oh, they rigged them up as chariots and things like that, you know. I can't really think of anything in particular. Some of them were fessed on with streamers, and somebody even dug some balloons up somewhere. I don't know where they got them.
Right, the next thing then is the move into Austria, up through the top of Italy and into Austria. What do you recall?
I can't recall from whence this vehicle came. We acquired a 3-ton short wheelbase Bedford, lower chassis, not like a truck carrier, that had been adapted for a bolter gun, sort of mobile gun thing. The gun had been removed and it had been reconverted into a more or less a truck carrying vehicle, but it had a very powerful winch at the back, quite a long winch. And as I was about the only one that knew how to work it, I got stuck with this. And I was quite pleased, really, because there are a few practice spins with the winch and found I could work it all right, and so I took that over into Italy.
Into Austria?
Into Austria, rather. From Italy into Austria. And I was loaded, I didn't have trips in, I was loaded with empty stuff and some of the quartermaster's surplus stuff, and notwithstanding the fact going down the top of the mountains and going down into Austria in the very early hours of the morning, convoy stopping and starting as it was, it played a great havoc on the brakes of various vehicles, and this thing that I was driving obviously hadn't been checked out properly, and I began to lose brake power. It was more and more difficult to stop. Some parts of the road were more and more st- steep and that. I was constantly changing down into a low gear and holding my breath and hoping that I could stop at the next stop. And on one occasion, I actually drove into the, there was a high, this particular spot, there was a high bank on the left hand side, and a virtual drop of some 600 feet on the right hand side, very narrow road. And I wasn't nervous. I could see everybody stopping in front of me, and I just had to bump into the vehicle in front. But it stood its ground, and there was no damage done, much to my relief. But there was no way to do anything about it till so I had to keep it in a very low gear until we got to a reasonable point. And we finally got into our street and went to the, had to take it to the nearest owner's car workshop. That would be in Plangford, I think it was, or in the vicinity of Plangford. And apparently there was virtually no brake fluid left at all. And just made it by the skin of my teeth.
Now, your first base was at Unsmarkt, I think. And that's where you met the Russians and began setting up POW camps.
That's right, yes.
Were you involved in that at all?
Oh, yes. That was very, very sad, really. We didn't realise the position. A lot of these Austrian villages that we went to, the Russians had very badly, but then there was nothing unusual about that because it soon became apparent that they realised that they were having to get out and handle what it was, and they were determined to go and leave nothing worth having for us to have. So if there was any wine, for instance, to splash the stove, the barrels, you know, whatever, and flooded the cellars, splashed pianos and things like that.
And the Russians had done that, not the Germans.
The Russians did it, yes. But they were more regular troops than genuine Russian army men who appeared later.
What about the German POWs?
Well, there was still a few arrogant, typical Germans, but the majority of them were only too glad that it was over and wondering where they were going next. They were completely demoralised, dejected, and hungry. And only too ready to do anything they were told to do. There was piles and piles of German arms, even, you know, small arms and things like that, and piled along the sides of the roads and in clearings.
Was there a lot of souvenir collecting?
Oh, there was, but later on there was a big clear up, and you weren't allowed to keep these things, and so actually it was a waste of time trying to get them in the first place. Although Lugers were at a premium because the Americans would give themselves how many cigarettes or whatever for the Luger.